Well, recording in progress.
Good evening. I'll call to order this City Council meeting of the City of Atascadero. And I will ask Councilmember Darez to lead us in a pledge to our flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
And we'll ask Councilmember Darez.
Which stands one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call, please.
Councilmember Borbo.
Here.
Councilmember Darez.
Here.
Councilmember Funk.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Newsom is absent. Mayor Moreno.
Here. Thank you. If you are, all of you attending this evening, welcome. We're glad you're here. If you are listening live on the webinar or you are on the phone, you're on KPRL 1230 AM, you are, let's see, Channel 20, you're on YouTube. There are so many ways to be involved in the City Council meeting, which is great. And if you would like to call in for community forum, you can do so in the following manner. This would be either public comment on an item on the agenda or for community forum. You would dial 669-900-6833. Once again, 669-900-6833. And then you would use meeting ID 889-2347-9018. Again, 889-2347-9018. And if you have the agenda in front of you, you've got all that information on that front page. When you do call, please let us know what item you'd like to speak on. And with that, I'll ask for a motion to approve the agenda.
I'll second.
A motion by Councilmember Borbo, a second by Councilmember Funk. We will waive the reading in full of all ordinances appearing on this agenda, and the titles of the ordinances will be read aloud by the city clerk at the first reading after the motion and before the council votes. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Borbo?
Yes.
Councilmember Funk?
Yes.
Councilmember Darez?
Yes.
Mayor Moreno?
Yes, ma'am.
Motion passes.
Thank you. We are on to some presentations. We are celebrating awards this evening. Yay. So we're going to start with our 2022 Champion of the Community, Mark Capozzoli. Mark, are you here? Good. Excellent. And you can stay there, and then I'll ask you if you want to come up once I'm done telling everybody how amazing you are. The City of Atascadero is proud to announce that the California Park and Recreation Society, CPRS, District 8 selected Mark Capozzoli for the 2022 Champion of the Community Award and the Colony Park Pickleball Courts for the Excellence in Design, Facility, and Park Planning Award. Yay. Absolutely. The Champion of the Community Award is a service award of excellence that honors and recognizes individuals or organizations who have contributed significant effort to influence and improve the quality of their community through parks and recreation. This award recognizes the contribution of volunteers that provide support and services that further the mission and quality of park and recreation services, programs, and facilities in their community. Mark Capozzoli, also known to many as Coach Cap, has volunteered in Atascadero for dozens of youth sports leagues, programs, and activities for many years. Mark's volunteer work includes coaching youth sports, serving as a Boy Scout den leader, a youth soccer referee administrator, a middle school volunteer, dance committee member, and high school PTSA president. That's a lot. Mark has volunteered for 5 years as the Little League president, plus over 14 years of coaching with the Atascadero Little League Baseball, Atascadero Youth Soccer, and the city's Youth Basketball League. He even stepped in to help with traffic control at an Atascadero elementary school when needed, and worked with our local police department to improve safety for students that has earned him the recognition proven by the many volunteer hours devoted to these groups and organizations. Mark and his wife, Jill, are also mentors to new foster families. The City of Atascadero and CPRS District 8 would like to thank Mark Capozzoli for all of his support for our community youth sports programs over the years. Congratulations, Mark.
Thank you.
Sometimes people sit in the back because they don't want to come forward and say anything. Welcome, Coach Cap.
Hello. Well, thank you very much, Mayor, for those kind words. Obviously, I'd like to thank a few people. My mom, who happens to be here, who always taught to give back. My wife, local school teacher, who knows how important it is for the youth to grow and to prosper. So I've kind of taken it with them to get involved. We moved here back in 2008, and at the time we just had one child, my son Jack, who's over at In-N-Out working tonight, and got involved. And we got involved in the community to meet people and to better this town when we moved up here. We kind of left a little bit of our big city attitudes down south and thought we'd come to this nice small town and make it grow and watch it grow through the kids, through youth. Currently, we now have four kids, three more, and which has been great. And just continuing to grow this community through the kids, giving all kids an opportunity to be successful at whatever it takes for them to be successful at. This is actually a special moment, too, because the gentleman here to my right, him and I became friends back in 2010 and has been what I would call a dear friend. Got to play on his basketball team with him back in the day when I was a lot less big and I could run up and down that court. But Chief Haley has definitely been someone, and like I said, welcome back. Great to see you. This actually means a lot that you're here. It really does, because we spent countless hours out on the road eating sandwiches and figuring out ways that we can kind of keep our town a little bit safer for the kids around the school. So welcome back. Thank you, everybody, for this wonderful award. I don't think Larice is here. There's Larice. Can I have Larice come up real quick for me, please? Come on, Larice.
Come on up.
So I'm sure everybody knows Larice. So I got to know Larice years and years and years ago. And through thick and thin and through COVID and not, she's always been the person who's been at the forefront with our kids. And I don't know how many of you people out there talk to all the kids out there, but they all love Larice. So when I got involved and I said, hey, here's my cell number, call me if you need something. Of course, needed something, which is fine because we did it together. And the group of people that we have here with Jennifer Fanny, and I know I get to talk to you a lot through Little League, Terry Banish, everyone else here in the community helps the kids. This is our strong point in this community. We can't overlook the youth in our community. We really need it. And for me, there's a lot of people out there that have been with me through the beginning and through the thick and the thin of volunteering out there for youth sports. Again, I call it my village, our village, and our village is what makes it run. And really the chief in all this is Larice. So thank you again for putting my name out there. So thank you very much. And
thank you, Mark, and Larice, of course. Things happen here at Atascadero because of the volunteers, and Mark, you are just a shining example of that. Thank you for all that you give to our community, to our youth. And we will do pictures, Terry, don't worry. But I thought we would do it all together, so we'll do them separately but together, if that makes sense. Separately but together? She knows what I'm talking about. All right, on to, what was that other award? The next CPRS District 8 Award is for the City of Atascadero for Excellence in Design Facility and Park Planning Award, which recognizes excellence in the design of a completed aquatic, recreation, cultural, and/or park facility intended for public use. The project may either be new construction or rehabilitation and maintenance, quality of aesthetics, usability, accessibility, and versatility. This award further recognizes the design and construction or significant rehabilitation of buildings, structures, and facilities used primarily to support park and recreation purposes. On Saturday, November 13th of 2021, the City of Atascadero and the Atascadero Pickleball Club celebrated the official ribbon cutting for the opening of four permanent outdoor courts at the Colony Park Community Center. And I remember that because I played very poorly. It wasn't pretty. With 48.8 million players nationwide, pickleball's popularity has increased nearly 40% over 2 years. Popularity has surged because the sport is easy to learn, fun for all ages, energetic, great exercise, teaches hand-eye coordination, which apparently I need to learn, team play, and generally includes lots of laughter. Yes, it does. City Council and city staff, from the City Manager's Office to Public Works and Recreation, all worked with the Atascadero Pickleball Club to identify an area that would be the best location for the outdoor courts that would be available to public use every day of the week and bring a very popular sport to the community. Through many meetings, construction permits, and approvals, Kirk Construction of Atascadero was hired by the city to construct the nearly $250,000 project. Funding sources for the permanent outdoor pickleball courts included $150,000 in city parkland facilities impact fees, with the remaining funding from generous donations and in-kind services collected by the Atascadero Pickleball Club. The courts have ADA accessibility for inclusive play and were designed to require minimal ongoing maintenance. The fence courts are located behind Colony Park Community Center and Joy Playground, and we encourage everyone to give pickleball a try. Thank you to everyone involved for turning this reality into, or this vision into a reality. And thank you to CPRS, thank you to the CPRS District 8 for this award and recognition. So, yay, and congratulations to you. Well, all right, Rich, he's got, I like that. And I think Barbara, is Barbara here? Okay. Is there somebody that would like to say a few words on behalf? Please come forward.
My name is Bob Brown. I'm the current president of the Atascadero Pickleball Club. And on behalf of our 135 members plus, we want to congratulate you on this award and us. And I've said many times it's a great example of how the private sector and public sector can come together and accomplish great things. It's been a bumpy road. It was a tough road, but we got it done. So in the short time that we've been using these courts, it's been almost less than a year. They're very busy, and also there's been a few changes. We created a shade court, shade area to provide shade for players as they sit and wait in between games. We created better access onto the courts. For safety reasons and also to get people quickly on and off the courts. And lastly, we installed permanent plastic supports that go over the nets, short fences for safety. So just quickly to borrow a phrase from the Field of Dreams, you know, if you build it, they will come. When we started this project and, you know, when Barbara and her group did all the heavy lifting back then. When they were dedicated, I think our membership was around 50 or 60 members, and now being up to 135, it really represents that. If you build it, they will come. So possibly, maybe someday, we might be back here talking about more courts. You know, we've got a perfect venue.
It's the first we've ever heard of that.
Perfect venue. We've got a perfect venue laid out. You know, sunken gardens. Why not? What's not to like? You know, how hard could it be? Yeah, that's right. Seriously, thanks. It's been great working with you guys, and we look forward to doing our part to support this city, maintain the courts, not only for our club, but for the public as well. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Brown, and thank you. We appreciate all of you and all that you do to keep those courts up and that you lobbied and raised the funds that you did and really got that going. So thank you. Why don't we come forward? We'll take some pictures. Why don't we start with Mark, and then you guys decide if you all want to come up, and we'll make it work. All right.
To see you back.
Like after every speaker, everyone's not clapping, like that disrupts and stuff, and so, but you can wave, and right. So you all wave the pickleball, and it was really nice, yeah, nice. That worked well.
Thank you.
Email me, just a small group, you don't have to. Exhibition or whatever. Just, yeah. So just call me anytime. I'd love
to. We need to get one more picture outside here.
Those are some of the most fun things we do, like our employee recognitions, awards for people. Those are the fun things. I wanted to also mention, Mark kind of stole my thunder a little bit, but that's okay, that we do have a returning member of our staff, at least temporarily. We want to welcome back Chief Gerald Haley, who is serving as our interim police chief. And Chief, would you like to say a few words?
I've told the city manager this, and I've told you this personally. I love the community of Atascadero. I love the people here. I love the men and women in the Atascadero Police Department. And it truly was an honor to even be considered to come back by Rochelle. I consider it a privilege to count her as one of the most professional people I know. And to come back to the community that I was so embraced in is flattering as well. And so I'm happy to be back. We're going to get some good work done while I'm here, and we'll start paving that road for the next police chief as well. Lots to do, but I'm refreshed after 2 years away from it and excited in a way. I've told some people it's like starting high school, but with all the knowledge that I have now. So I'm going to do everything we can to continue the professionalism that you have come to expect from our police department while we're here, and improve upon that even more. So thank you.
Thank you. We're very glad to have you back and part of our team again. All right, we were going to move on to our consent calendar. Consent calendar contains items that are considered to be routine and non-controversial by city staff and can be voted in one motion unless there is a member of the council or public wishing to pull an item. So I will look to my council members, see if there's anyone wishing to pull an item. Seeing none. See, it's nice. I don't have to look side to side. I can actually see them on camera. And I will look to, do you see someone in our webinar? If you wanted to comment or pull an item, go ahead and raise your hand. Is there anyone here in the, I'm not seeing anyone. All right. So I will go ahead and ask for a motion on the consent calendar.
I'll move approval of the consent calendar.
I'll second.
Motion by Councilmember Bourbeau, second by Councilmember Darras. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Bourbeau?
Yes.
Councilmember Darras?
Yes.
Councilmember Funk?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem. Sorry, Mayor Moreno?
Yes, ma'am.
Motion passes.
Thank you. And we are now on to updates from our city manager, Ms. Rickard.
Good evening, Mayor and council members. Before I get talking about events, which we have a lot coming up, it's that time of the year. Of course, with Terry, every time of the year is that time of the year. But I want to celebrate something else. So we are very pleased to announce that the Fitch ratings for our community redevelopment tax allocation bonds has been increased from AA to AA+. This upgrade reflects improvements in growth prospects for revenues and financial resilience. And Fitch assumes similarly strong revenue growth given continued growth in the redevelopment area and the tax base. This rating also speaks to the city's long-term financial stability, thoughtful planning, good use of the city's resource, and I'm going to add to the strength of our finance team. Jerry and her team do an amazing job in keeping the financials keep us moving in the right direction financially. So good news. Thank you, Jerry. Good job to your team. I also want to give another thank you to the Friends of the Lake and the volunteers that came out for the annual Lake Perimeter Cleanup Day on Saturday. So we appreciate all of the volunteers that make this day happen. The Friends of the Lake lead a huge charge, and everybody that gives up their Saturday morning to go out there to help prune, clean, clip, drag, haul, all of those things. It's a lot, and we appreciate it. We also appreciate our public works team for pre-cleanup, for getting the necessary permits, for providing the tools, for helping clean up afterwards. And we want to thank the Atascadero High School Key Club, who came out this year and did a fantastic job. A total of 2 dumpsters were filled with remaining piles to be picked up. So thank you to everyone that helps make this day possible. I mean, as you said, Mayor, it takes all of those volunteers in addition to the city to make Atascadero work, and we appreciate it. On to the many, many events. So Halloween weekend is upon us, and there's quite a number of fun Halloween activities. So want to make sure everybody knows about them. As usual, our Mark Russo, our former public works worker, while he has retired, he is continuing to do his Halloween spooktacular every year. So every evening now through Halloween between 7 and 10 p.m., the Russo Spooktacular Halloween House will be open for visitors for a spooky annual Atascadero tradition. So on Halloween night, the Spooktacular Halloween House will offer walkthroughs to the public. It's located at 7720 Cortez Avenue off of Kerberil Avenue. Head east towards the Jim Green Trail there. So Mark works extremely hard every year, putting in a ton of time and effort decorating for Halloween. And each year his spooky display just gets better. I've noticed a lot of his neighbors now also put a lot of stuff up. It's fun. Even if you don't go by on Halloween, go by ahead of time. It's worth just a drive-through. We also have our own haunt. The haunt is our local haunted house here and is located right in the downtown. They're open every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday now through the end of October and have a special programs like their Halloween special on October 30th and 31st, Night Terrors and the Lights On Tour. All of the information, including their schedule, ticket availability, and pricing, can be found online at thehauntinatascadero.com. And buy your tickets in advance online, as only a limited number are available, and it's a very popular thing. I think Laura and her family went. She had a lot of things to say about it. She said it's spooky. It's good. Very, very well done. It's worth a go look if you like haunted houses. This Saturday, October 29th, from 5 to 8:30, is one of our favorite Zubu at the Charles Paddock Zoo. So get your costume ready and bring the entire family to the zoo. You can expect Halloween decorations throughout the zoo, along with carnival games, Halloween activities, a haunted house, and trick-or-treats to enjoy. I was out there last week, and Flavia, our resident zookeeper artist, was out there painting different things that were casting shadows on the ground for the meerkats, bats, and stuff. Very, very cool. We have a lot of talented staff here. Admission for the event is $15 per person. Zoo members are $14 per person, and ages 2 and under are free. If you can, please help us go green and bring a reusable trick-or-treat bag. And Zubu is brought to you by presenting sponsors Pure Pediatric Dentistry and Guesthouse Grill, supporting sponsor State Farm Insurance Agent John Donovan, and in-kind sponsor Waste Management. So we look forward to seeing everybody at the zoo this Saturday. And then Sunday, we will have Trunk or Treat in the downtown in the Sunken Gardens for the first time. It's going to be on Sunday, October 30th from 5 to 7 p.m. This event is being hosted by Atascadero Bible Church, along with other local churches, for a fun evening with food vendor, games, movies, and more. If you are interested in hosting a space to decorate your vehicle and hand out candy, please contact Sandy at abcchurch.org, or you can contact the city manager's office and we can get you some of that contact info. So the event is free to attend for all. They are trying to get people out, and it sounds like a fun event. And then, if you're not tired from Zubu and Trunk or Treat, on Halloween itself, October 31st, from 5 to 8 p.m., we'll have Trick or Treat on Entrada. This safe, family-friendly event will be held on Halloween, Monday, October 31st, from 5 to 8 p.m. in the downtown. Bounce houses, there's a hay maze, and over 20 vendors join in the fun. And this free-to-attend event is brought to you by the Atascadero Downtown Business Improvement District, the Atascadero Chamber of Commerce, and the City of Atascadero. That's a lot. This coming weekend, join in. It's a lot of fun. And now we're to November. Let me tell you about some of the things in early November. So we're going to have First Fridays in the downtown will be taking place on Friday, November 4th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the plaza across from the Sunken Gardens. So the City of Atascadero is proud to present the second First Friday fall concert with Unfinished Business. This popular band plays 60s and 70s covers and offers great music to sing and dance to. In addition, Bubble Fun 101 will offer complimentary bounce houses for the kids, along with 2 food trucks to choose from. Bring a low back chair and get your dance shoes on, so come out and enjoy a beautiful evening in the downtown. Make sure you hit a lot of our local businesses will be open there. Great place to walk around fall first Fridays in our fall concert series. On that same weekend, we're also going to have the Bovine Classic World Class Cycling Weekend, November 3rd through 5th. This event is touted as America's fourth hardest cow-themed wine country gravel road world cycling experience. I really do want to know what the top three are, because we can beat them, Terry. We're going to be the number one cow-themed wine country gravel road world cycling experience. This ride attracts riders from all across California and the United States, and actually from other countries as well, with over 300 riders. Riders will be seen in North County starting on Thursday in Paso Robles, Friday in Creston, and Friday night in downtown Atascadero. On Saturday, November 5th, the Sunken Gardens will be the location for the main bovine festival, featuring riders departing for the big bovine course and coming back to enjoy the festival starting at 12:30 until 6 p.m. with a variety of vendors, live music, raffles, and an award ceremony. This event is brought in partnership with the cities of Atascadero and Paso Robles, Paso Travel, and Atascadero Business Improvement District, along with the event planners Brian Yates with Locomotive and the team at Bike Monkey. So for more information on all of our events, go to visitatascadero.com. And one last thing I want to make sure everybody remembers and knows about: our waste management residential drop-off day at Chicago Grade Landfill. So this opportunity is for Atascadero residents only, going on now. So you could do it today, anytime through Saturday, October 29th. Saturday, the Chicago Grade Landfill is only open from 7:30 to 3 p.m., but you can go any of the days between now and then. So you can deliver acceptable items to Chicago Grade Landfill just in your personal vehicle. You can't bring a big giant trailer. Residents must unload the items themselves. Only one voucher per household. So what you do is you contact Waste Management, get a voucher. They're available from Waste Management located at 8740 Pueblo Avenue, Suite B. Or you can call them at 805-466-3636. So again, this event is for Atascadero residents. You can get a voucher, bring your stuff to Chicago Grade Landfill at no cost if you get that voucher from Waste Management. And again, that number is 805-466-3636. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you guys may have.
Thank you so much. Any questions? All right, seeing none. Got a lot going on. Thank you, Terry. And to the community. Sounds like a lot of you are doing a lot of things out there. It's great. We are on to community forum. This is the portion of our meeting that is reserved for persons wishing to address the council on something that is not on our agenda this evening, but over which we have jurisdiction. We do ask that when you speak, you state your name for the record. You'll have up to 3 minutes, and community forum overall will be limited to 30 minutes. I was like, one speaker only. And anything brought up tonight will not become a subject of conversation, but we will triage the best we can to get any answers or clarifications that might be needed. And with that, I will welcome our first speaker.
Good evening. My name is Zach Jackson, current president of the Atascadero Professional Firefighters. Tonight, I just wanted to say thank you all for your support for our 100-year anniversary. As you know, we've been celebrating 100 years this year. This whole entire year, we've had several events, community events, events that we've done with our past firefighters. We found that it was no better way to celebrate the end of our 100-year anniversary with our annual Fireman's Ball. Our Fireman's Ball is going to take place December 31st at Spring Hill Suites. It's going to be open to the public. It's one of our biggest fundraisers. It's actually sponsored by our nonprofit association, Atascadero Volunteer Firefighters Association. All the proceeds that we make go back to our community. They go back to scholarships, Alicia Ann Ruth Byrne Foundation, and various other things. We've had the barbecue for Keith Dozier, who's battling ALS, one of our local citizens here. We use those funds to put back into our community for everyone here to help support everybody as we do. So Spring Hill Suites, December 31st, open to the public. We're going to have a silent auction. It's going to be a sit-down dinner. There's going to be a band, dancing. Should be a great time. We're working all of our, we're getting our planning committee together, so we're finalizing all the details. Tickets can be found on 805-TIX online. We're not going to sell tickets at the door, unfortunately, because it is a plated. We're going to have to know what you're, what you guys want to eat, because there's going to be a choice for the menu. So thank you all.
Thank you. Next speaker.
Hi, my name is Randy Carminati, just a local resident. Welcome back, Chief Haley. We've got a really cool picture with you, Dance with the Stars. Pretty funny. Anyway, I wanted to say, concerned citizens, we have La Plaza, beautiful building. There, right where that speed bump is, I would like to request, if you guys could, to put some sort of lighting like we have over here at the southern end for when people cross the street. It's dark. I've seen a lot of foot traffic, which is amazing. Thanks for all of that, because we haven't had that. I was born and raised here, and that's new. But I've noticed that a lot of people cross at that moment, at that intersection, going to the street side or whatever, and it's just kind of dark, and I think that we should address that. That's all I got.
Thank you, sir. Next speaker.
Jeff Oslin, business owner, resident of Tascadero. First of all, welcome back, Chief. Do have a bone to pick with you. I'll pick it publicly. You could have done Dancing with Our Stars. You gave me enough grief and my wife enough grief, and you were in town, so not off the hook that easy. Moving forward, this one's more for Nick, but obviously it has to go through council. The intersection at Del Rio and El Camino Real is fantastic now. It is lined. My million-dollar question is, when can I sit at a stoplight that's under 30 seconds and not 2 minutes and 48 seconds? Because that is still on the non-whatever you want to call it. So that's a big one. Another note, I know you have an agenda item coming up that I will speak at, but I do have two concerns that probably council, city manager, or city attorney should address first. If we're recusing Council Member Derez from being on the housing agenda item. My question is for council, for others that are on council that this may affect as well with future building. Why do they get to sit there? That's my question. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other members of the public wishing to speak? Anyone here in chambers? If you're on the webinar, you can raise your hand. And I'm not seeing anyone on the phone. All right. We'll go ahead and close community forum. And since we have no one else wishing to speak, community forum will remain open until 7:03 p.m. And so at this time, we will go ahead and move on to the next item. But if there's anyone that would like to speak either here in person or raising your hand on Zoom, go ahead and do so and let us know. We will get to you at the earliest possible opportunity. But for now, we will move on to our next agenda item. With regards to, what do I want to say? Mr. Oslin, with Del Rio and ECR, like staff can get with you to answer your specific questions. And Randy, you had mentioned the, you know, safety and lighting down there. We are doing a lot with the downtown enhancement, so those kinds of things will be coming. And if there's any specific information you'd like, I know Public Works can get that for you. So thank you. And with regards to why or why not people are recusing themselves, we will move into that shortly with our public hearing. So we are on to our public hearing. This has been continued from originally September 9th, then to October 13th. Do I have my dates right? And now to tonight, or October 11th, I think it was. Whatever the second Tuesday was, that's when it was. So we are back to that hearing, and yes, we do have a council member, Derez, who has a few words for us.
Yes, I believe I'm going to have to recuse myself for a conflict of interest since my business deals some partially with ADUs.
All right. And we will wait for Councilmember Darris to leave the premises before we get going. I can obviously ask our city attorney to weigh in, but council members are not required to recuse themselves if they may in the future have some conflict. You know, I think of like the vacation ordinances that some of the cities have passed, and if someone has a vacation rental, they have to recuse themselves. Just because someone may in the future have a vacation rental, that would not preclude them from voting. But let's see, Mr. Pyrick, there you are.
Yes, I'm sorry, did you have a question?
Mr. Oslin was asking why Mr. Darris, we understand, has to recuse himself, but why, if the three of us sitting up here could potentially someday build an ADU, why we don't need to recuse ourselves?
That would be a remote interest, I think, and it would be one that would be shared by anybody who was serving as a council member. And if we followed that logic, then there would never be an opportunity to take any action because it could potentially happen. I believe that the situation with Councilmember Darris is much more direct and creates the issue which has caused him to recuse himself.
And my understanding is that if for some reason all of us did have to recuse ourselves, we would pick straws and the three short straws would need to do the vote.
or the three long straws.
Or the three long straws. Short straws, long straws. So, yes.
Yeah, that's that the legal term for that is the rule of necessity. You are correct, and it could be any one of a number of methods, and the one you've described is one.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Pyrick. So as we move on to this item, I will turn to Mr. Dunsmore. We have, as I said, we've gone through this pretty significantly back in early September, and so what we're really coming back with are some key points that we wanted to see addressed. And so we're not going through the entire thing again, but we're really honing in on a number of issues. Now, when it does come to public comment, any of you can comment on anything. And of course, any of us, if we have a question and we want to talk about it, we can bring that up. But just know that we're focusing in on these key areas. Mr. Dunsmore.
Thank you, Mayor. And thank you for setting the stage on that, because I really did want this to be a lot briefer than I even have for you tonight. But since our last discussion on September 13th, there has been some more changes that the state has brought us. And we've had some more legal review of this topic. And so there's a little more information to give you tonight than I had anticipated when we all left each other on the 13th. We thought we were just words away from adopting an ordinance. But as you've seen in your report, there's a few extra pages there, but I think we can get through this. And I'm going to try and go through a few of these topics that, let's see, my computer will work if I can forward my slide. It's not going. Look at that. Ah, there we go. Anyway, a couple points for tonight's action. Primarily what we want to do is respond to the comments that we did get last time from City Council. We do have also, like I mentioned, alluded to just now, a couple of Senate bills that have passed in between that time that have tweaked a few of the things about accessory dwelling units that we had to change the code again with. We also had some corrections, some typos that we'll have to go over a little bit. And then hopefully we'll get to introduce the ordinances tonight and get there. I just have a couple slides just for those that that weren't with us last time, and just to bring everyone to speed on what we're actually talking about. Accessory dwelling units, they come in different forms. We also have junior accessory dwelling units. In essence, really, these are extra units that are allowed on residential properties, commercial properties when in a mixed-use format, a multifamily property, along with a legal primary dwelling unit. A few of the points that the state law sets aside is that these can't be used as vacation rentals. Generally, CC&Rs can't regulate them, and we do use them to satisfy our affordable housing requirements when it comes to our what we call our RENA, which is our regional housing needs in our area. So that's a really key point. In terms of different accessory dwelling unit types, I just want to touch on that real quick, too, because there's an attached accessory dwelling unit that's attached to your primary unit. There's a junior accessory dwelling unit, which is always internal to a primary structure. You can also have a detached accessory dwelling unit, but you could also have an internal accessory dwelling unit along with an internal junior dwelling unit. So there's all kinds of different ways this can happen. I just wanted to touch on that basic thing. And then there's the whole urban dwelling unit law, which we discussed at length several weeks ago as well. And that further changes what you can have on your property, bringing that total to 4 with your principal residence, your junior ADU, your ADU, and your urban dwelling unit. And it changes what you can do on your property quite a bit. So I always want to throw these images up there. We can come back to this. Didn't want to spend too much time on that. But essentially, the state has given us a lot of new things to talk about. So here's the list that we left with last time. This is the comprehensive list that we wanted to go through each one of these topics. I'm going to touch on each one of these topics tonight and show you what staff has come up with in terms of edits to our proposed code. We really wanted to clarify the units that were permitted with an urban dwelling unit and an urban lot split. We wanted to really focus on two-story ADUs and what a sort of, I'll call it design standards, we're able to place on those and not encouraging those units at the same time. We wanted to look at slightly increasing an attached, I'll call it an attached accessory structure, or what we call unconditioned space, where you can't live in it, but it's an attached portion to that unit. We really wanted to look at the parcel size of properties that aren't served by sewer. I think the Planning Commission had recommended 0.5 acre, and we settled on 0.75, so that change is in there now. And since we met last, we've also had a lot of discussion with development groups and with staff and others and our legal folks about mixed use. Why is that a portion of accessory dwelling units? Because accessory dwelling units are allowed in mixed-use projects, and we had to come up with a definition for mixed-use projects so that a commercial property didn't end up as a 100% residential project. So a little bit of crafting there. We'll discuss that. We also had to remove the language regarding the size of an existing structure for determining the size of an ADU because it just didn't really seem to fit the way our code was coming together. And then we'll have some good discussion about larger ADUs and what options we have there. So let's just start each one of those points. And I'm going to go through some of these fairly quickly. And what we can do at the end of my presentation, we can go back and focus on some of the areas you'd like to talk about further. And also have here tonight with us Kelly Gleason, our senior planner, and she can chime in as well because she wrote a lot of this. So she might kick me and say, no, that's not true, which happens sometimes. So an ADU with an urban lot split. We wanted to add some clarification here just because the language was a little confusing, and so we added the language where it says already exist or are approved for construction. In other words, what can you do on a site with an urban lot split? So this clarifies that language. We can come back to that. Two-story ADUs. Now, this is one of those things that I'll talk about a little more later as well, because it's where the state law has played with the heights a little bit, and they've played with the setbacks a little bit in their most recent Senate bills. So now the state law says, well, it said previously, but it's modified this a little bit, that you've got to allow, you know, minimal setbacks of 4 foot for a 16-foot high ADU. And that's the minimum allowed for a detached ADU. 18-foot minimum for a detached ADU on a site that's got multi-story dwellings. That's a new interesting twist. And that 25-foot minimum for attached ADUs. So where that ends up with our proposed code is the following. What's being proposed now is a maximum height of an ADU shall be as follows. 16 feet high in a single-family zone for any detached ADU where the setback is less than the minimum standards. Right now, our minimum standards in most of our residential zones is 5 feet at the side, 10 feet at the rear. ADU law allows you to go down to as low as 4 feet, but even if someone had, let's say, you know, 9 foot in the back, they'd be restricted to that 16-foot. Now they've gone a little higher where you have something in a multifamily zone for a detached ADU where you have that lesser setback. if that multifamily dwelling is on the same site as a multi-story structure. So it starts to get really, really complex. And I'll tell you also, in the future, we're going to have a guide for how to interpret this code. We're going to have handouts. We're going to have graphics because we're going to have to. We're going to be spending a lot of time coaching applicants on what all this stuff means. Number three there, another height limit, 20 feet for a detached ADU that complies with the setbacks of the underlying zoning district. And that's an important one because, hey, they've got a 5-foot setback on the side. They've got 10 at the rear. So we're essentially saying that 20 feet is the maximum height. Now, 20 foot would allow for a two-story structure. Doesn't allow for a structure to have a really high, steeply pitched roof and two stories. Now, if they increase those setbacks, the proposal here is 15 feet at the side and rear, which normally it's 5 and 10, that they could actually go up to 25-foot height. So these are the provisions that staff designed in here to reduce the overlook issue, to increase neighborhood compatibility, and to discourage, again, as council recommended, that two-story structure. And this is where we have that discretion, even though the state has put in some mandates about going taller and about reduced setbacks. Once you go over those minimums, you do have additional discretion for these additional design standards. Lastly, a 25-foot height limit for an ADU that's attached to a primary dwelling. And then lastly, we're basically saying that the cap is two stories, regardless of any of these height limits. Again, we can come back to these. Now, speaking about setback, the side setback, our base standard, is a minimum of 5 feet, except if they comply with that state minimum height of 16 foot or less than that, and they're with a regular, you know, primary residence on the property, they can actually be 4 foot from the side. Same as for the rear, too, and I'll go over that real quickly.
Director, I'm going to ask you to just get a little closer to the microphone, maybe, because you're...
Am I too far away?
That's a little better. Thank you. I want to make sure everybody can hear and
thank you for letting me know. Number two on there, ADUs that are greater than 20 feet in height shall increase that side setback to 15 feet. Now, I know I mentioned this in the previous section, but this sort of duplicates that discussion in the setback discussion. And then lastly, ADUs that are 18 feet or less in height that are on a lot with a proposed or existing multi-story, multi-family building may be set back up to 4 feet from the property line. A lot of confusing, overlapping different standards and very similar standards for the rear setback. I'm not going to read all these because they're essentially a repeat of the side setback, the same height standards, the same exclusions. And this is a real quick one. We all agreed to increase the accessory structure space, 250 to 300, 450 to 500. Those changes are now incorporated. Property's not connected to sewer, 0.75, 3/4 acre. All right, let's have some discussion here. We can also come back to this. I'm going to introduce some discussion on a couple things. Mixed-use development. Previously, we brought to you a definition that had a ratio in it. It was 40% of the project area or 30% for a three-story, you know, that could be residential. We did hear a lot of grief from the development community that a lot of projects such as La Plaza, such as other recent mixed-use projects, wouldn't work under that scenario, because a lot of spaces are counted as residential floor areas, such as interior hallways and all these other things. We can still have a ratio, but the discussion instead has leaned to just really calling mixed use this vertical separation of land uses, where commercial and residential land uses are different land uses on different levels of a building and are subject to compliance with that allowed density, and that residential uses shall not be allowed on the ground floor. Now, right now in our code, we do have a footnote in our residential land use table that has been there for many years, and it was designed to preclude the construction of an elevator in a smaller mixed-use project or multifamily project where didn't want to have the residential entirely on the ground floor, but that you could allow a unit on the ground floor and a multi-unit structure so they wouldn't have to install an elevator, so they can instead have that ground floor accessible space. But the building code really only actually allows for just a portion of that structure, just a portion of that residential unit, and they call it a powder room, to be on the ground floor to still get out of a potential elevator requirement. Now, again, all of this is only done to preclude the construction of an elevator. We're not required to mandate residential on the ground floor. We do it because we don't want them to incur the cost of an elevator on a smaller residential mixed-use project. So our code for a long time has said that a unit in a commercial district could be on the ground floor in a multi-story project where there's other residential units upstairs. But it never set a size threshold of what that unit could be. It never said how much of the ground floor it could take up. And it allowed it to be in a complete unit. So we have seen projects over the years, and we have a new one in now, that has substantial ground floor residential units in a commercial district. And we're unable to control the size of those units or how much of that ground floor they take up. And so what happens is that project becomes predominantly a residential project in a commercial district, even though most of the residential units are upstairs. So what we had proposed to do is modify that footnote to say that if a project's required to comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act, the portion of the unit required to be accessible per the California Building Code may be located on a ground floor. So what that would mean is only this entry and a powder room would have to be on the ground floor, not the entire unit, dramatically decreasing the scope and scale of a residential use on a ground floor in a commercial project. Now, there's a couple other different ways that we could do this. I want to talk about a couple of options. You can set other standards for that space, such as a maximum floor area ratio. You could say, hey, it's a certain ratio compared to the commercial space, like 30%, for example. And if you had a 2,000 square foot commercial space, then, you know, you could end up with, you know, let's just go with 1,000. You could end up with a 300 square foot residential space, or with 2,000, you could end up with 600. So something more reasonable. Or we might go to just a cap, you know, not to exceed 500 square feet, for example. Let's come back to this discussion. I wanted to plant the seed on those potential items that we can do, a little bit of flexibility on what we can do with that definition, but wanted to give you the reasoning behind it. The other big topic tonight that I know you will want to discuss is the 1,200 square foot. The maximum recommended size is still 1,000 square feet. I think in our previous rendition we had said that on larger sites, an acre or more, perhaps we should consider the 1,200 square foot still. Or should we have other options? Could we do other property development standards? These could include looking at not only lot size, but larger setbacks. We could do height limits. We could have a minimum bedroom count. We could do other property development standards. And the reason that the minimum bedroom count is there, this is an important one, the more bedrooms that an accessory dwelling has, the higher its rent amount can be while still counting as affordable. That's the only reason for that. But still, it's very difficult for any 1,200 square foot accessory dwelling unit to really meet those affordability standards that are set by the county to allow us to include these units in the future for our arena. So some options for discussion, and these aren't the only options. Staff came up with three options to look at this potential. We could do something that has a 1 acre or more lot size with increased side and rear setbacks, such as 10 foot, and even increased setbacks if there was a second story, like an additional 3 foot. Or in scenario number two, property is a minimum of 1 gross acre and the ADU contains at least 3 bedrooms and there's at least a 10-foot setback from the side and rear property lines. And then it could be required to be a single-story structure or limited to 18 feet along with any other property development standards that are applicable to that section. Or we could just say 1,200 square foot's allowed everywhere and not have any conditions. So these are kind of the variables that we could go and put into the ordinance for a 1,200 square foot ADU. But some very important considerations for affordability and just for neighborhood compatibility, and in consideration of everything that's allowed to be built now on a single family property in terms of the junior ADU and the urban dwelling unit and the accessory dwelling unit and urban lot split potentially. So I'm going to finish up this presentation. We'll go back to those points. I do want to touch on the state law changes. State law did talk about a few changes in the recent Senate bills. One of them was parking. And when a new application comes in and they want to do the ADU at the same time, that we don't have to supply parking for that ADU when it's submitted concurrently, and whether it's a multifamily or single family. So we had to put that in. And a demolition permit for a detached garage that's to be replaced with an accessory dwelling unit to be reviewed the application for the accessory dwelling unit and issued at the same time. Another one, they're just trying to streamline the approvals on how these go forward. Some other ones, these all pertain to what I'll call subsection E. There's a subsection E in the government code in 658.58.2 that really provides for a lot of flexibility for accessory dwelling units. And this is something we had to vet quite closely with our legal team to discuss, you know, what these sections really mean. And so instead of putting all the meanings into our code, we essentially have put references in our code to say that nothing shall prohibit the construction of an ADU in accordance with this government code, section 658.52.2e. In essence, what it does allow for, one of the more significant things, it allows someone to convert an accessory structure, such as a barn or a garage or workshop, that may have been constructed even without permits, into an ADU, regardless of its size. So it's a very interesting exclusion that they have in the subsection E. There's also some different size provisions and different provisions in that... I think are still ongoing discussion between a lot of local governments, a lot of cities, and HCD. And so it, rather than put all those provisions in here in this whole subsection E, we thought we'd put the references to them so that if those scenarios come up, they can refer to that section. And hopefully HCD, when they review this, are comfortable with the way we've interpreted that. Lastly, when we did publish this, again, there was some clerical fixes that I'll note on page 52 and 53 and 122. You might have noticed that there was some wording, especially confusing on the setback where we meant side when we said rear. And then some of the wording on height was a little confusing as well. So we've clarified a couple of those things. And we can talk about those details a little bit. But finally, it is our recommendation to introduce the draft ordinance A, which would repeal all of Chapter 5 of Title IX. Our accessory dwelling unit ordinance would be replaced. Our secondary dwelling unit ordinance would be replaced with our accessory dwelling unit ordinance. And then the other one, which is Chapters 5 and 18 of Title IX, which relate to the definitions. For the most part. But let's go back to some of the discussion items at your pleasure that we'd like to talk about. And staff would be happy to answer questions on those items. Thank you.
Thank you, Director. Okay. Why don't we just kind of go piece by piece there? So where we're going to start, do you happen to have a list of, I think probably if I just go in my staff report here, if there's sort of a list of here are the things that we want to go through. Let's see.
Page 27 of your staff report.
Yep, there we go. I'm starting with it. Starting on page 28. So updating the language, let's start right there. I want to make sure, are there any questions about this language? Councilmember Funk.
Yeah, when we discussed this before, the concern that at least I had about this language is that it wasn't clear to me whether this applied before or after the lot split. So are we talking about the lot before the split or the lot after the split? And it appears that our legal beagles have looked at this and decided that it was perfectly clear to them. I'm not so sure that I'm perfectly clear with that. So I wanted to see if that's clear to others on the council, because it's not clear to me. It's not clear that we're talking about the lot that is, that we're talking about each lot after the split and not the original lot before the split.
Well, I think the way I read it is because, one, an urban lot split has been approved, so now we're already talking about two parcels, and then two units already exist or approved for construction that would be on each of the individual remaining lots.
That's exactly right. That's exactly it. So what we're trying to do here is tell the public that, sure, you can do your essentially four units if you haven't done an urban lot split, but if you split that lot, you can still only do four units, two units per lot. That's really what we're trying to say. Right. The urban lot split doesn't get you more units. It just gets you separate ownership of the same quantity.
Okay. And will this be accompanied, in the code, of course, it's going to just be language, but in the materials, this is going to be clear. And then, once you draw it out in pictures, it's pretty clear.
We will make handouts that include images like this that are even better than this, which have maximum development options with a lot split or without a lot split, what you can do in each scenario.
And just to point out as well that these images are a part of the definitions within our code section, and so those images are available as part of the code.
Okay, great. If it's accompanied by image, then I can work with that. Well, and I think the risk is small there in that if people think that it might be discouraging them from doing more, they're going to keep looking.
Oh, that's for certain. Yes.
Yeah. It's like, but I thought I could do more, and they'll keep looking. As opposed to the other way around, yep. If we risk giving people permission for something that we weren't intending, that's more of a problem.
Agreed. All right. Any questions on your end?
No, I think this language is clear with the big if there. I mean, it kind of clarifies it adequately.
Excellent. All right, so on to next one. We're looking really at the two-story, which is really talking about the height. So, and this changed quite a bit because of some of the state laws. A couple of questions I have is if somebody meets the setback of the underlying zone, is 20 now the maximum height, 20 feet?
That's what's being proposed, yes.
Okay. And then, but 25 if attached. And it doesn't, but there's nothing about, 25 foot if they're, and then 25 if increased, 15 on the side and the rear.
If it's not attached.
If it's not attached. If it's attached, then there's no setback required. Is that, that's how I'm reading
it? If it's attached, there's still a 20, there's still a 25-foot height limit, but they still have to, if it's attached, they're going to have to comply with the standard setbacks.
Okay.
Is that not clear?
Yeah, I guess I don't even know why we add the one about the attached then if it's a 25-foot height limit. If setbacks are... they'd have to meet the... So number five would have to meet the underlying zoning setbacks, not the 15 and 15.
Correct.
That's correct.
Yes. Okay. And keep in mind, too, there's some districts that are multifamily districts that have a taller height limit than 25. It's 30, right?
It's 35, I think, in multifamily and 30 in single family. So these would be reductions in the overall height that normal structures could have to make sure that they're truly accessory.
Understand. Thank you. Other questions? Councilmember Warbow.
Well, your comment, staff just prompted popping in my mind to ask a question. You're saying these are decreases because decreases from what the primary could be because these are accessory structures we're talking about. And therefore,
that's right.
That's why you're looking at a lower height limit than.
Correct.
Because I'm always, you know, concerned about lessening what people can do. But if we're talking about on the accessory structure compared to the primary, I can understand that. Thank
that's
you.
Exactly it.
Yeah, my question on this one is with regard to number two, where it says 18 feet in a multifamily zone for a detached ADU. What about if the detached ADU does not meet those setback if the conditional is if the multifamily dwelling is on the same site is multi-story. So what's the limit that applies if that final clause is not true? If your multifamily dwelling on the site is single story?
It would be 16 feet if you're at 4 feet from the property lines, and then it would be 20 feet if you are meet our normal setbacks, which is 5 feet from the sides and 10 feet from the rear.
And how do we know that from this language?
So let me just point out very quickly, sorry. One of the last slides were some of the corrections. Okay. Number one was corrected. Can you go back, Phil?
Yes. Sorry, we touched the screen.
Yes. We got rid of in a single family zone. So it now says 16 feet for any detached ADU where the setback is less than the minimum.
Thank you,
so
Michelle.
That
I forgot
will
to change
cover
this.
That multi.
I forgot to change this slide.
And thank you for clarifying that's because standing on its own, I'm like, that's grammatically incorrect. I don't understand. But now that you tell me where it belongs, that makes total
it's
sense.
It's not just in single family. It's anywhere. So the single family is in.
Yeah, no, that helps.
Out. So.
Okay, great. Thank you. That takes care of my. My concern there.
Okay. All right. I think with all of the new requirements, you've done well, you know, pulling this all together. So thank you. On to, where are we now? Okay, so side setback. But on the other slide, some of that includes side, like for the exceptions. So now we're.
Side and rear, essentially the same.
Yes.
For their heights.
Yes.
So
basically, you're just clarifying some things here that were all in that initial first list that you gave us, or breaking it out
in
a
essence,
little bit more. Yeah.
Yes.
And what we did is because our height now is tied to setbacks, we had to sort of add some of those setback things in just for consistency with our height section.
It is duplicative, unfortunately.
Okay. And sometimes that helps, then somebody sees it twice, and that's okay. Questions, Councilmember Borbo.
To be clear, number one there, that is mandated by the state, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, the on item number three, where we're looking at the setback, it says it may be setback up to 4 feet. Is that also on the typo list? Could you go back to the typo list and see if we fix that?
Yes, it should say a minimum of 4 feet.
And that is on the typo list.
It is.
Okay.
I should have changed these slides as well.
And it's both for the side and rear, but that's
same,
been corrected.
Same exact thing for this one, too.
Okay.
It says maybe here as well, but it should be.
Okay, good enough.
Yeah.
All right. I think with those clarifications, there are no further questions there. And you did talk about sort of ensuring the updated code is designed to incentivize second stories, but there was nothing particular there. Council members having any questions on that? No, on just the idea of ensuring that, you know, as we're looking at this, do we feel like this code is not, you know, getting any extra incentives to second story? That was one of our concerns. So just want to.
And the intent of these height limits in these first six that we talked about here, those are designed to not incentivize the second story, and that's why those numbers were set. We had
and so I just wanted to make sure my colleagues were had any questions with regard to that. Okay. Okay, so now on to number four, increasing that garage or other unconditioned space. This is something we had done previously. I don't know that we have any questions here.
You know, I thought I did have a question on this, but I can't remember what it was.
Okay, let's quickly move on.
You better move on while you can, I guess.
It is the same one we did for
SB. No, I understand. I understand. Subsequently, though, yeah. I had a question.
Okay, so then, yes, the 0.75, I don't think we have any questions on that. So clarifying the mixed-use definition. Okay, questions here.
I do have a question. I think the answer is going to be it'd be something to be dealt with at another time, because we're talking about vertical separation here, and there may be some lots like in the K. Johns lot on El Camino Real comes to my mind, where you have commercial buildings out front and residences in back, so you have a horizontal separation on a mixed use situation, and I'm not sure what it took. I guess that was allowed at the time, but I gather that that is not something that would be allowed under our current ordinance, correct?
That was actually done with a general plan amendment and zone change to actually rezone the rear portion of the site to residential to allow that to occur.
Okay. But, I mean, that's what it would take if we at some point looked at a particular situation and thought this is big enough, deep enough, whatever, to have commercial out front, residences in back. That's not something we can or should address relative to this, but it is something we could address down the road, right?
Great discussion for the general plan update.
Right, exactly. Right. And very few people understand that we actually have a mixed-use general plan designation, and we don't have it incorporated anywhere in the city right now. So what we're talking about when we talk about this is in our commercial districts. But we actually have a general plan designation called mixed-use, and that's where it would be appropriate to have the horizontal mixed-use type project, or simply to change part of the site to residential, part to commercial. But when we speak about this, we're talking about commercial sites where our preference is to preserve the commercial and the predominance should be commercial.
Right.
Okay. These other considerations can happen with the update for sure.
Right. Thank you.
Other questions?
So what was the... I'm not clear on. I know you had a discussion with regard to some folks that our requirement had been so tight that you couldn't have built La Plaza, and between our requirements and the building code requirements. But since that's a building with an elevator, and they can put ADA units further up,
So
I don't understand
the reference that I had made is an original definition we had said that in the entire mixed-use project, at least 40% of the floor area of all interior space shall be commercial. Or in a three-story structure, that ratio could be reduced to 30%.
Oh.
But the reality is because the upstairs interior hallways are considered residential space, and we could do the calculation differently, but because of all the units up there and all the interior hallways up there, and because of the garages that cut out a large portion of the ground floor in the back, that ratio for La Plaza, for example, is probably 28%, really, even though there's 16,000 square foot of commercial. It's a lot of commercial. The ratio is still pretty tight. And there's other projects, too, like the block on Traffic Way, where it's much, much smaller ratio commercial. But that's a very unique site. It's so steeply sloped, and they couldn't fit anything else out there physically. And so we wanted to take that into consideration. That's a good discussion topic, because there are unique sites, and you do want to have certain flexibility as to the percentage, while still exclaiming that, hey, these are commercial sites. It should be predominantly commercial, except for whatever you can fit on your upper stories.
Okay. So, finish. I'm sorry.
If we're trying to do something that allows a functional ADA unit on the ground floor, since the building code is going to require at least part of one down there anyway, what's the size of a residential unit that is functional for a small ADA unit? the minimum, so, you know, for a minimum size. I mean, if you do something, you know.
I mean, the typical size of a studio apartment is about 450 square feet. The minimum, you know, building size for a unit, really habitable units, around 320 square feet. So you can do pretty small units. Now, I should also remind you, the building code doesn't mandate that we allow ground floor residential or a portion of a unit. It simply says that if you're going to comply with the ADA, that all you need to do is add a portion of a unit on the ground floor to qualify to not have to build an elevator. Or you can build an elevator and you qualify for ADA, or you could build a whole unit and qualify for accessibility if that unit is accessible. But it doesn't mandate we allow for a ground floor unit, just mandates accessibility. And we've been really, really friendly by saying, we're not going to make you spend tens of thousands of dollars on an elevator. We'll let you do a portion of that unit, or actually our code says now, we'll let you do the entire unit downstairs. But now that mixed use is becoming so much more mainstream, and that residential square footage is so much more valuable than commercial, and that there's new Senate bills that mandate that we allow essentially mixed use by right, and that there's these ADUs that are allowed in there as well, it's time to, okay, we really need to dial in this definition about what's allowed on these ground floors. Otherwise, you are going to lose a lot of commercial land to predominantly residential projects in a commercial district.
Right. So if we wanted if we don't put allow for a whole unit of a minimum size or some percentage, then they would need to put a powder room and an entrance on the ground floor.
That's
and
the
then,
bare minimum.
Then connect the rest of it to the to a unit, an ADA unit that you're going to connect with like a stair chair or something?
In that case, it might be. It might be someone who is not completely reliant upon a lift, so then they could actually, you know, make their way upstairs. But certainly, that's all the building code requires, is this portion. It's an interpretation. The other option is, to build a lift or an elevator, and then it's automatically accessible, and you don't have to have any portion of that unit downstairs. But for someone that's building a 2, 3, 4, 5 unit project, that's just not economically feasible, and that's why we have that exception written in there. But now we're getting projects that have 4, 5, and 6 buildings on a site, all in one project, and the developers are coming to us and saying, okay, I get to do a large ground floor unit on each one of these buildings in my 5-building project, and so now you've got a project that's predominantly residential. Yeah. Therefore, how do we play with this a little bit? And there's several different ways we can do that.
Okay, thank you.
I'm afraid I'm going to get into the weeds in this to understand it. So, because you just mentioned something I hadn't thought of, so currently, our ordinance allows for somebody to put in an ADA-compliant unit on the ground floor of a mixed-use project. Is that right?
Yes. When that project has more than 2 units upstairs, they're required to have an accessible unit. So therefore, our code says, all right, you can do one on the ground floor now.
And I'm not – is there a ratio in terms of how many units you have, for every so many units you have to have an ADA? In other words, if you have a 100-unit building, do you have to have a certain number of ADA-accessible units?
Yes, there is a ratio.
Okay. I'm assuming, though, that when you're talking like 4, 5, or 6, it's only one unit.
Correct.
I'm not sure.
I think it's even, you can even get a higher number and still just have one unit.
And, of course, elevators are very expensive, so I'm not sure.
It doesn't pencil to have an elevator unless you've got at least, 10 or more or 12 units.
And so our current ordinance then includes a percentage, but it's the percentage applying to the overall square footage of the entire
building, not project.
Building, right, not just the first floor commercial. And I can understand why that would be problematic. Is there a reason why we in the past have done a percentage? And are you're proposing to do away with that percentage requirement?
We haven't had a percentage ever. We've always had a footnote that simply allows for a unit, no percentage. The building code is what has the percentages. The state governs that. But our zoning code right now simply has that footnote that says you can build, when you're required to do accessibility and you're in a commercial zone, you can build a ground floor unit, period. No size limitation, no ratios are put in that zoning code at all.
Wait, you're saying the building code says that?
The building code is what mandates accessibility based on the number of units that you build that are upstairs, multi-floor.
Okay, but I thought your percentage.
Our city manager.
I think we might be talking different percentages. Councilmember Bo, are you talking about the amount of square footage that can be devoted to residential versus commercial?
Yes.
And I think, Phil, you're talking about the percentage related to how many ADA units you have to have?
That's right. Sorry.
Right. Yes. See, I'm trying to understand what we've been doing and where we're proposing to go. And I'm following on Councilmember Funk's questioning where, you know, we're talking in here about saying you can't, to make it so you can't build an ADA unit on the ground floor. You can build an ADA bathroom or powder room, as they call it, and an entry, an ADA accessible entry. But I think it seemed a little incongruous to me, and I think to most people, to suggest that, you know, we're going to create units that are designated ADA, but somebody's going to come in through a door, have access to a bathroom, and then somehow they have to make their way upstairs. Maybe that meets the legal definition, but that doesn't sound real logical to me. And that's why I think she asked about, like, one of those, you know, are we talking like a chairlift where you just go up the stairway? And are we suggesting that as an option just to try to preclude folks from putting in too many residential units on the ground floor?
That's the reasoning.
Okay. And you brought up the issue of, like, on a site where you might have multiple buildings and then somebody saying, well, I want to put a residential unit in the bottom of each one of these commercial buildings. Couldn't that just be limited by, you could do this in one building on a site?
No, it's per building. So we have to allow that. And they could do a three-bedroom accessible unit that's 2,000 square feet on the ground floor of each building while having 400 square foot non-accessible units upstairs.
Okay. And while having a small amount of commercial on the rest of the ground floor?
Yeah, there's no limit. They could say, all right, we're going to do 500 square foot commercial buildings or 400 square foot commercial spaces, and we're going to have 1,000 square foot ground floor residential units, and we're going to have 3 500 square foot residential units upstairs in each building.
And why have we seen that? Where
yes.
People have actually built that in town?
Yes, and we have projects that are being planned for that now.
Okay, and so this language you're referring to is intended to kind of preclude that, and so that commercially zoned property is not, you know, artificially turned into residential property.
Yes, in a way, yes. Right now, we basically are getting such demand for mixed use, which is really 90% residential, that it's changing the way I think that we, you know, want to zone property. So we need to set aside mixed-use properties. We need to set aside residential properties. We need multifamily, but we also need commercial. And so it's disingenuous to say that, okay, you can do a 100% residential project in something that we assumed would be preserved for commercial. And I think we want to encourage mixed use. I think it's very healthy for the community. It's a great use of certain properties, but got to ensure that we can at least have a viable commercial space on the ground floor of each of these new buildings that does get converted to that, if we're going to zone it commercial. Otherwise, rezone the property. Let's look at something different. And that's certainly an option with the update. It's certainly an option after the update.
It just seems to me that we've had a lot of discussions in the past on various projects, and maybe I'm misunderstanding the application of this, that I think of the tiny home project up there that has, you know, some commercial in one of the front buildings, certainly the principal project on Principal Avenue.
And both those were rezoned to residential.
Yep. Okay. So there were some other caveats and limitations as to what. Okay, because given that kind of loophole, if you will, I'm surprised that hasn't been happening all over the place. And so the only way you see to limit that is this language about only allowing a bathroom effectively.
No, there's many different ways it can be done. I think the other options are you could limit the size of that residential space based on the size of the commercial space as a ratio, or you could simply put a maximum cap on the size of that residential unit that's downstairs so that we wouldn't get a large two or three or four bedroom unit as accessible. Mm-hmm. Or you could go to the original thought, which is in the building code, which says you only need a portion of that unit to be downstairs.
Well, I think,
or to be what they call 100% accessible, because there's all these different levels of accessibility that they design units to.
All right. Well, thank you for pointing out those two alternatives, because I think that's more viable than just limiting it to, a bathroom downstairs. I mean, limiting the size of the unit or limiting the percentage of the ground floor that goes for this purpose may be more straightforward options. So thank you. That answers my question on that.
Okay. All right. I think we are ready to move on to, removing language regarding the size of existing structures. That's all good. So now we're on to the 1,200 square feet. And you came up with a couple options, or three different options for us to consider. And so let's look at that. Questions from my colleagues.
Yes, because, this at the last meeting, this was one of my primary concerns, was being concerned about reducing the 1,200 square foot limit for folks and trying to understand, of course, how many people, how many properties that might affect. You made note on page 33 of the staff report that out of 128 ADU permits since 2006, only 9 were greater than 1,000 square feet on parcels smaller than an acre. But do you have a good guess as to, out of those 128 ADU permits, how many were built on properties over an acre, and how many were 1,200 square feet?
I don't have the total on properties greater than an acre, but there were 37 that were over 1,000 square feet on properties greater than an acre.
Okay, that's actually a little less than I thought, but it does show there's substantial interest in where viable in doing 1,200 square foot ones. And in here, and in particularly in option 2, you talk about allowing 1,200 square feet on the acre, properties over an acre, although I thought we were changing it to 0.75 if there were some other criteria that were met. But 3 bedrooms in terms of that requirement. You mentioned about that, affordability, meeting RENA requirements, regional housing needs allocation for the public. Haven't we met our requirement in the sense that we have zoned in our housing element sufficient properties to allow for affordable units to be built if the market then builds them?
We have the land, potentially, and the zoning to do it. That's one of several criteria, but we still have to show that we've got production and that we can meet our quota over time. And we're getting there. We're slowly making our way. We have a really hard time with the low and very low and extremely low. We have always beat our quota on the moderate. And so with the state now saying that we could count half of these towards low, if we can continue to demonstrate that they really meet that, that's huge in helping us get there.
But from the state's perspective, you can only count 1,200-foot ADUs if they have 3 bedrooms?
No, it's not exactly that cut and dry. It might help us if all of these had 3 bedrooms in them, because the affordability levels that they rent for are, the allowable amounts are higher for a 3-bedroom. But we still think that if we have 1,200-square-foot ADUs on these nicer properties, that they're probably going to be in the moderate level, not in the low or very low level, even if they have 3 bedrooms. So it's not a guarantee. It might help us a little bit to maintain affordability.
But we're talking about telling somebody what kind of house, that they've got have 3 bedrooms in a 1,200-foot structure just because it might help the city meet an administrative requirement from the state. That it might help, right? You're talking about applying this on acreage properties, where there's tons of room for setbacks, et cetera, and then we're going to tell somebody, no, if you're going to be able to 1,200 square foot ADU, it's got to have 3 bedrooms.
And a lot of them do end up with 3 bedrooms anyway.
Sure, I understand that, but that depends on what they're building the ADU for. And any ADU built, you know, creates housing. So I'm just having a hard time wrapping my head around how this is the three-bedroom thing being, you know, what's the impetus behind it.
And it's just one more step towards affordability in that direction that the state wants us to go.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for the answer. Got it.
I think, Director, what you said at our last meeting is we were saying that after this sixth RENA cycle, which will go through 2028, then we'll be able to do a review, which I think you said SLOCOG will be doing, of, you know, actual affordability and seeing if what we have said is affordable, what we're assuming is affordable, actually plays out and is affordable. And so I think what I'm hearing you say is that there's a much stronger likelihood that 1,200 square feet with three bedroom would qualify as affordable because you're able to obviously house more individuals and the rent, you know, per person or however that's calculated as affordable would be more likely with that situation than would be, say, you know, a one or two bedrooms home in a 1,200 square feet.
Each bedroom you add has higher thresholds for what is low and very low and moderate. Yeah. So certainly, and in future, each city will have to do their own analysis. Right now, we're relying on a countywide analysis that was done, and the state was okay with that. But in the future, we'll have to do an Atascadero-specific analysis mm-hmm. to demonstrate what ADUs are renting for. And we'll have to come up with that data to justify it to the state.
Councilmember Funk.
Yeah, so continuing on that theme, with if somebody builds a 1,200 square foot ADU and they only want two bedrooms in or one bedroom because they want to do a big art studio or some other sort of thing that they've got going on, if we have enough other people that build ADUs, and if they're doing 1,200 square feet that they have three bedrooms in them, does it matter that somebody doesn't? What's the downside?
Well, each expensive ADU that's out there that potentially is, you know, renting for a higher amount or is more valuable is going to begin to erode the data. But certainly, yeah, it may balance itself out. You know, if we get a whole bunch of 400 square foot ADUs and we get, you know, a few 1,000 square foot and we get just even fewer 1,200, then it may balance itself out. The incentives are definitely geared towards the 749 and less because of the development impact fees. Our stock plans that are coming out are all 1,000 square foot or less. That's a huge incentive. There's other incentives for engineering and pad development that's also geared towards smaller accessory dwelling units that will be coming out. So there's a lot of things that will incentivize that anyway. It's a lot more expensive once you go over 750 and once you go bigger and you've got to do your own plans and everything else. So that potential is probably not going to be as desirable as it was anyway. So that's another consideration.
So is the issue the average rental for all the ADUs in the community, and if it's too high, then we lose credit for all of them? Or is the issue that if you have a few of them that are really pricey, they don't count, but everything else does?
So what the next study that we are contemplating with SLOCOG to do to prove affordability of ADUs specifically is they're looking at doing a square footage-based study. So right now, based on our countywide study, we can just say 50% of all ADUs, regardless of size, are low and 50% are moderate. That will morph into what square footage is considered affordable. Applied to ADUs, there might be some additional information in the study on regular dwelling units too, and a multifamily and an apartment style unit, so that we can start counting some smaller units that are not ADUs towards affordable housing, which would be great. And so when we really tie it to square footage, the larger the unit gets, especially on our larger lots on the west side, we don't see a lot of affordability even at the moderate range with the larger units. We still see it somewhat with the 1,000 square foot units, but once we get into, you know, a three bedroom house that a family can live in on acreage, we don't see much affordability. And so adding the three bedrooms
might make us closer to that, but it also might not make a difference. And so I think one of the reasons that we included option two in the recommendation for the resolution was that this can sort of be a menu of items. And if the council did not think that the three bedrooms was an issue, because a lot of people building for their family with the 1,200 square foot ADUs on the west side are going to have three bedrooms anyways, and we don't want to dictate that, that can be sort of easily deleted out. And if there's any additional standards that wanted to be added in, we could easily do that and include that tonight, so we wouldn't need to continue the item for additional wordsmithing.
Okay, I'm still not quite clear if there's any risk that we lose credit for all of the ADUs if we have some that are more costly.
There is no risk today if we do that. We're at 50-50. In the future, it might be tied to square footage, so the larger units we allow, if more people go that way, we might lose those. But we
wouldn't
do
lose
not
them
have
all.
Information
you wouldn't
yet.
Lose the whole batch because a few are in there. The key is we would have less that we could count towards ARENA
right. In
the end. So it wouldn't say, okay, we're going to average them all out now, and now you just tip the scales, and that's it. Sorry. You're going to have to build some funky different apartments in the south end. No. I think it'll be, okay, they just have to delete those out. So.
Okay. And you mentioned that there were 37,000 square foot, or 37 units that were over 1,000 square feet on properties of over an acre. Do you happen to know of those, how many of them were something less than three-bedroom units?
We do not track bedrooms. I would say that most of the 1,200 square foot units, probably all of them were three-bedroom units. But when we get close, you know, 1,100 square feet, some of those might have been two bedrooms, but even those usually come in at three bedrooms.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Regarding option three, you know, allowing 1,200 square foot with no conditions, it's always, we're the government, so we're hearing the word no conditions. It always feels like that comes with conditions. When we say with no conditions, what's, from your perspective there, what's the downside of allowing that? I mean, because there are other criteria that have to be, you know, met. Obviously, I mean, if they're going to do it in a septic situation, it's got to meet the criteria for that. If it's on a slope, it's got to meet the criteria for that, because these are all limiting factors on our wide variety of lots we have in our town. I can't see saying no condition in terms of height, you know, because you don't want to have somebody plop their ADU on a 5-acre lot right next to the neighbor's fence. When you say no conditions there, are you really just talking none of these conditions, or what do you mean?
We wanted to provide options that just run the full gamut.
Right.
And you can use a menu, you can use nothing, or you can use several items. But the risk of doing nothing at all and just saying we'll allow 1,200 square foot anywhere and everywhere, now that we've got urban dwelling units and a junior accessory dwelling units and urban lot split, you're essentially then on a lot of properties forcing two-story construction with minimal setbacks just because you just don't have the space on some of these properties.
Right.
And that's why I think the original recommendation was look at larger lots and look at larger setbacks and look at height limits, because otherwise you are going to create a lot of neighborhood impacts with the number of units on each property and a larger unit, especially with an ADU, you're forced upwards.
Right. Thank you.
And let's not forget that, you know, the change in fees and the fees, you know, people think of, oh, like the city's making money off the fees. Like, no, that actually is helping provide the services, particularly roads, infrastructure, that type of thing. And when the ADUs are not, you know, any unit that is built that isn't paying the impact development fees that are actually required to service that unit, it is then borne by the rest of the population. And so that's something we're dealing with, because now we have this requirement, and it's a new benefit to anybody building an ADU, is now you're paying much less for that ADU. is there, I'm guessing the answer is no, but would there be an option that we said, okay, you could do 1,200, but you would be paying the full impact fee that would be required? Kelly's shaking her head no, so I thought not.
It's a no because the state already preempted us on that. They told us that we have to pay, we cannot pay a fee that's greater than a proportional rate of an average single-family resident, so we already have a calculator for that was adopted.
Yeah. And as you said there, while, you know, I know Councilmember Borba, you're hesitant to take away a benefit that some have had, but now there's a whole new benefit of, you know, UDUs and lot splits and reduced fees. And so I think a lot of that is balancing out. But we can talk about that more. Any other questions as it relates to the 1,200? All right. Seeing none, I think that was the end of it, correct? All right. So now what I'm going to go ahead and do is open up to public comment on this item. If you are on the webinar, go ahead and use that little raise hand icon. And here in the chambers, welcome. Oh, and actually, before you do that, we've already done this in the past, but I want to do it each time. If I could ask my fellow council members if you have any ex parte on this item.
Yes, somewhere before or after the last meeting, I think after the last meeting, I did have a conversation with Mr. Oslin at his request on this subject. And I believe somewhere in the past, I've had a discussion with Mr. Zappas, Max Zappas.
Thank you.
And we've received multiple emails that you've probably all received as well. And I did reveal I had a conversation with somebody from the manufactured home sales place in Paso Robles.
I have received all email messages and communications, but don't have anything to disclose.
Same with me. So, right, thank you. Please feel free, Mr. Oslin.
Thank you. Jeff Oslin, resident here in Atascadero. First of all, I want to thank council and I want to thank our city staff because I think the extra time that they put into this has cleaned a lot of things up and it looks way more professional, so thank you. I only have a few questions and concerns at this point. So first of all, 16 feet in height is kind of a standard on the ADU, and I believe I saw 18 somewhere else, so maybe a clarification on that. When it comes to 4-foot setback or 5-foot setback from a property line, I think somewhere in there a note should be made for people looking at that if you're at 4 feet setback, you have to meet a much more stringent fire code, where at 5 feet you do not from your property line. So just something that maybe we should spell out. The mixed use, I think you should come up with some form of a standard for a maximum ADU if that's what you're trying to do, like in the commercial zone. That's a pretty good idea, I think. 1,200 square foot, I'm still hot and heavy on keeping that, and I think it should be at 0.75 acres to be consistent with everything else or above if you have the room to do it, along with a 500 square foot attached garage. This will not affect me one way or another. My permits will be in before the second reading, so therefore none of this does affect me, but I'm just telling you that makes sense. The next couple things are, what's the definition of a bedroom? What's the square footage minimum of a bedroom? I know a definition by my standard is it has to have a closet, but it doesn't say 100 square feet or 500 square feet. Just a crazy, crazy world there. So, you know, I will tell you mine will be 3-bedroom. It doesn't really matter because that makes sense to me. I have a house that is 1,299 square feet. That is a 4-bedroom home. So I don't think it really makes a difference. And I think going to 1,000 square feet is not adequate for those that have the property to do 1,200 square feet, that may have family living there, that may need to do some type of separation if you have 2 in-laws or something of that nature. And then lastly, even on the 749 square foot ADUs, I still think a two-car garage makes sense, and maybe it's defined if it's set alone and not part of a UDU. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Oslin. I'm looking to the webinar. If you would like to speak, please do raise your hand. Luke, what is overflow room? That's the first time I've seen that. Oh, okay. All right. We got people viewing. Excellent. So last call. Anybody want to raise your hand? Anyone else in chambers wishing to speak? No, seeing none. All right. We'll go ahead and close public comment and bring that back to council. So Mr. Austin's questions, the 16 versus the 18 feet had to do with the 18 feet, I think, was on multifamily, correct? 4 feet versus 5 feet and the setback and the fire code, stringent fire code. Maybe you could speak to that and would that, where that would be.
Yeah, there are some additional standards when you go less than a 5 foot setback in terms of how many openings you can have and what those openings look like. So a lot of structures that are less than 5 feet to a property line can't have operable windows, right, and can't have certain features like that, but of course can still be constructed to meet residential standards.
And I think the question though is that, will somebody know that as they're doing this and making their plans, or are they going to say, oh, I can do a 16 foot and be 4 feet and put this whole thing together and then come in and nope, you can't have that window, you can't.
Yeah, I think because that's a part of building code, which has its own amendment process, we wouldn't want to necessarily codify that because we do then have some inconsistencies when the building code changes and some of their rules do relax over time. But as Phil said, as part of our sort of brochure and handouts, we will Perfect. Be including that information.
Perfect. And got your input on the other things. Oh, a 749 square foot two-car garage, making sense. I don't think we're able to, well, we can't dictate parking in something like that. But in a 700, since Mr. Austin brings it up, in a 749 and under square foot ADU, what size garage? Is that the 300 square foot that someone could build, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, okay. All right, thank you. Okay, so bringing that back for conversation, for my notes, I think the two things were we seem to be in consensus on everything with what staff's recommended, and the two places where we are really looking for some more direction are on the three possibilities of the mixed-use footnote. So why don't we take a look at that, and then we'll move on to the 1,200 square foot size. So hearing from both of my colleagues and what you had to say this evening, it sounds like you might want to be considering something more like a footnote three. Would you bring up footnote three? Or I was calling it three, I guess the third option, not footnote three. But, you know, what is your sense of where you'd like to be, Councilmember Funk?
We're looking at the mixed use criteria. Or?
Correct, okay. And the accessibility and the okay. three potential footnotes. And so one would be saying, hey, you just need to meet the state requirement, which, you know, currently is a powder room. Or we could say, you know, you could have one unit not to exceed 500 square feet, or you could have one unit not to exceed so much percentage-wise.
Right. And I think that we should set a standard that doesn't require not leave the only option is doing a powder room on the floor. That's just silly. We ought to do something that allows for a functional unit on that ADU, and it should be modest in scope so that it doesn't get to be... and doesn't take over the whole space that otherwise would be commercial. So you know, I'm comfortable with a 500 square foot, not to exceed, or I'm comfortable with a percentage or a combination of those, as long as we allow for something functional but small.
Councilmember Borba,
it is a question for staff on this. Is there any issue though in terms of saying 500 square feet if? You know, if the units upstairs are 1,200 square feet or 1,500 square feet, and to say, well, gee, we're forcing the, the ADA, the person in need of an ADA unit into a very small unit. is there any issue relative to that? Somebody saying, hey, I'd like to rent a 1,200 unit in this, you know, building, but gee, I need the accessibility, and the only thing you're making available to me is this little 500 square foot unit.
Interesting comment. I don't believe that there is a conflict with doing that. Okay. Like I've said before, a lot of these larger projects with larger units are going to have an elevator.
Understand.
Precluding this. Right. This is not the most common thing, but I see what you're saying. It's unfair. I have the smaller unit and everything else upstairs is bigger.
Yeah, somebody might make that argument. But, can we set this up so that if there is an elevator, then you don't, need to have this ability to do it.
You wouldn't have this if you had an elevator.
Right.
Anyway.
You wouldn't. So my other question, because either option, as the mayor noted, is a percentage of the ground floor, because you don't want too much of the ground floor turned into residential. But on a larger property, could you have it as saying, 500 square foot unit or, 15% or something of the ground floor, whichever is less. So if you had a very large ground floor, it could be a little bigger than 500. But
well, you're saying whichever is less.
Whichever is actually. Yeah, okay. No, you're right.
Yeah.
Right, or whichever is greater. I'm sorry, whichever is greater.
Yeah, yeah. That makes better sense.
My mistake. So, I mean.
That is certainly an option. You can do that. We're kind of flexible here on how that can be interpreted.
But
we're also wanting to make sure that you can't do this if you do an elevator. And so we're actually talking about that.
I believe we need to add that language.
I was just going to.
Yeah,
we're working on that now.
So I didn't say it there.
Yeah.
Right. Because, there's no reason to allow this if the building has an elevator and has accessible units upstairs.
Yeah.
But I much prefer this over the powder room option, because like Councilmember Funk said, that doesn't make sense to me. But this makes sense. Limiting that, the conversion of ground floor commercial space to residential, this is a sensible way to limit that, this or the percentage or a combination.
So if we did something like a combination, Ms. Gleason, maybe you'd have a sense, would you say, and I guess we're trying to look at, what might a typical floor layout be? So would we say 10%? Would we say 20%? Or what would, 500 square feet or the 10%, 20%, whichever is greater?
I mean, 500 square feet would be 10% of a 5,000 square foot first floor.
Right, of course.
So maybe 15% or something, I don't know. I don't know. What did staff think on that?
Yeah. I'm almost thinking the 10%, because if you're going, 5,000 square feet, 10%. So then you say anything greater than that, you'd get 10% and you'd be adding on to it. Yeah. How does that sound to you, Councilmember Funk? Okay.
Yeah, I can do
that. Yeah, so I think we're kind of leaning towards the 500 square feet or 10%, whichever is greater. Staff have any thoughts, comments on that?
Thinking about that. So let's see, that's 10%. Well, that's, the idea is a much bigger project's probably going to have an elevator, right?
Mm-hmm.
So these projects that we're dealing with probably are in the 3 to 4,000 square foot range maximum for their commercial area.
Okay.
So that does seem to work. You're probably always going to end up with that 500 square foot being the larger, because otherwise you've got, 10% of, you'd have to be at 5,000 square foot.
Or more to, so if you were
and
at
6,000, 7,000. What if you put an upper limit on it that said, 500 square feet or 10%, whichever is greater, but not to exceed 1,000 square feet?
That would work for me.
Yeah.
That way you don't end up with somebody converting 10% of Kmart into
residential. Exactly.
Okay, let's we'll work on language while we talk about the next item of discussion, because we also have to add the elevator exclusion onto this, which we have. Which is, if a project doesn't have an elevator, Yeah. And needs to comply with ADA.
And we can absolutely take a break after we have the 1200 discussion. And
yeah, we'll work it out right now. It'll just take a second, and let's go to the next discussion.
Sure thing. Okay, so on the 1200 square foot, we're going to need to come to some consensus here. Because the intention with the changes that have come down for ADUs over the last, particularly 2 years, two to three years, is geared towards affordable housing. So even if you have someone that says, hey, I'm on 3/4 of an acre and I'm not concerned with building affordable housing, I want to build a nice unit that I can, you know, run out to somebody and it's upscale or whatever, it doesn't matter. Like, that's use of their own personal property. Yet, unfortunately, the requirements that are coming in is that's not what's wanted. What's wanted is affordability and understandably, you know, so we're trying to balance those things. And because of that desire for affordable housing, we now have all of these incentives, and the incentives are things that are all in the favor of the homeowner, the developer, which is great. Yet the downside to that is there is a cost at, you know, at a community level, at a neighborhood level, at a city level. And so, you know, Councilmember Borbo, I've heard you say publicly, you know, concerned about taking away a benefit. I think a lot of the folks with the 1,200 square feet would be able to do, there are many that would be able to do a lot split or and have a UDU, and basically have 4 units on a current property. Anyone out on the west side is going to have well over an acre and could do a 1,200 square feet. So I don't know that limiting the 1,200 square foot to an acre or more is going to affect that many people. I don't think we know what that number is. I've asked, and we don't have a specific number of properties, but when it comes down to those who aren't on septic and who would be less than an acre and wouldn't be eligible for SB 9, I think you're kind of whittling that number down. So it's not, but I don't think we have an exact number. Would that be correct?
Yeah, we didn't look at parcels that weren't eligible for SB 9. SB 9, our urbanized area, is actually much larger than sort of our urban services area, which is where those smaller parcels are. So I would say that anywhere that is smaller than an acre and on sewer, you can probably do SB 9 as well as a second unit today.
Okay. So that's just my thinking, because with the ADU, again, you come with the reduced fees, all of that. There are a lot of benefits that someone is getting. So just that conversation of taking away a benefit, but yet they've been given many benefits. So I'm trying to balance that out a little bit.
Yeah, I think is there's an unknown number of properties, presumably small in number, who currently could do a 1,200 square foot thing. ADU that, you know, might not be able to with the 1 acre limitation. But I'm gathering, you know, that number, you expect that number would be very small.
Yes, the number that could not also do SB 9 now, right, as an added benefit.
Right. Understand that, you know, there'd be a trade-off. If somebody's in the sewered area, they now actually have, you know, some greater options. But there are some potential property owners who now currently could build a 1,200 square foot ADU, but they don't, you know, they're not served by sewer, and therefore there would not be UDU or lot SB 9 lot split eligible. So I am very concerned about those. The only comfort I take is that, you know, you're indicating that's a very small number of potentials.
Let me clarify. We looked at parcels that were less than an acre that are zoned residential. There are about 2,500 of those parcels. Right now, I think about 800 or so were less than 1/4 of an acre, 800 were less than 1/2 an acre, and the remaining ones were less between 1/2 acre and 1 acre. All of those, or the vast majority of those parcels, vast majority of those parcels, are now eligible for SB 9. We don't have a lot of small lots that are not eligible for SB 9.
Right.
But all of those right now are, in theory, maybe not practically, in theory, eligible to build a 1,200 square foot ADU.
Right, but for practical reasons, they may not be because of slope or just the configuration of the lot, et cetera, et cetera. Understand. I mean, so that presumably the number is very few. It would be. I am concerned about that. My greater concern on this issue that we're discussing here this evening is this wanting to mandate three bedrooms. That, I just don't see that. Because, you know, we're talking about, you know, somebody has plenty of land. You know, they're not eligible for SB 9 lot splits because they're in a non-sewered area on acreage, primarily out on the west side. And they, you know, want to build an ADU for maybe for family members, maybe to rent out, whatever. But, I mean, I have a 1,000 square foot ADU, which was built right before the allowance went up to 1,200. I mean, I would have loved to have 1,200, but I certainly wouldn't have made it a three-bedroom. So my point being that
I'm hearing you on the three bedrooms. So let's I'm willing to give on that, Councilmember Funk.
Yeah, I don't think we need to require three bedrooms. Okay. It sounds like most people are going to do that anyway. And if somebody who meets all the other requirements here wants to do one or two bedroom units for their own purposes, it doesn't sound like there's any. That the downside is damaging enough to justify or placing a limitation on what people want to do with their property.
I think we're in agreement. Let's go ahead and scratch the three-bedroom. It seems like probably enough people will choose to do that who choose to go over. And if they don't, then we're going to be okay with that. I think there is so much incentive with the 1,000 square feet and under, especially with the stock plans, and so we will probably see a lot going in that direction. And then when we do the study to show what affordability is, we're still, I think, going to have a large swath that are going to fall into that, so we should be good.
I would further comment on that particular one, that I do like the requirements in here with regard to setbacks. And I think the acre is there. I mean, the issue is not so much that you're taking away something that somebody can do with all the and adding all these after units, but they're doing that also takes away something from the neighbor next door who was expecting to live in an environment where things are a little more spread out. They got acreage and space, and suddenly you've got you know the neighbor's grandkids. Or living 4 feet from their property line. It's like, whoa, okay, this is not what people were expecting in the community, and it changes the character of how space is used. So I think if we're going to allow those larger units that we should limit it to, as proposed in number two, to properties of an acre or more and with the setbacks that are proposed.
I agree. Good setbacks make good neighbors.
All right, so I think what I'm hearing is consensus on number two, everything you have there, but removing the three-bedroom, and then, let's see, 10 feet, 10 feet from the rear and side. Do we want, on number one there, you've got a three-foot setback for a second story. Do we want to include that?
That's 3 foot additional setback, right? I
mean, on a second story,
right.
A layer,
I mean,
And again, that's to kind of prevent one of our concerns that we talked about back in early September was that overlook, so wanting to make sure that we kept that space and moved back a little bit so that if there is a second story, there's that increased privacy.
Yeah, I think we already have. The additional setback so that they're going to be at least 10 feet from the side and rear, which in our ordinary, in our current code, it's like 5 feet, right?
5 feet.
So
side.
This is already creating
five
that.
5 feet on the side. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 5 feet on the mm-hmm. side. So this already moves them back more. And I don't think we have to dictate the design of the second story.
Okay.
That's my.
And how are you, Councilmember Borbo?
I can live with that. I mean, my initial thought is I like the idea of the additional 3 foot setback, but I can live with that. I don't like imposing, additional costs through additional dictates. So I can, live with that as is.
Okay.
All right. I think we have consensus then. So we're looking at the 1,200 square foot allowed on an acre or more, this setback of 10 feet on the side and the rear property lines, 18 feet height limit, and, of course, all other property development standards. Perfect. So we'll go with number two. We'll take number two, Phil. Door number two.
Good choice.
All right. Do you need a little time to go over the mixed use, or do you want to bring that back up?
I think we're ready.
Okay. Do you want to bring that back up for us?
I could bring that back.
Okay.
All right. Let me see if I've got this wording. Laura has it as well, if she'd like to read it, but I'm going to go ahead and try. Let's see what we've got here. Oh, go ahead. Let's see what she's got.
All right.
It's not what you see on the screen, so I'll rewrite it.
Oh, okay.
It's residential uses allowed only on second and third floors. If a project is required to comply with the Americans with Disability Act, if no elevator is provided, one accessible unit not to exceed the greater of 500 square feet or 10% of the size of the required ground floor commercial space may be located on a ground floor.
So sounds
we
good.
We added the caveat that it not exceed 1,000 square feet.
Oh, yes, 10%, not to exceed 1,000
square feet. Yeah, 500 square feet or 10%, whichever is greater, but not to exceed 1,000 square feet.
Yep. Yeah, thank you for that room. Again, Kmart, right? They put a right second now. Story on and pretty soon.
So you want another and not to exceed 1,000 square feet total?
Right. For, okay. The 10% shouldn't exceed 1,000 square feet.
It's a and or but, actually.
The word required is giving us a little bit of grief on the commercial space. We do want to require commercial space, but we don't have an amount. And so it's still a good usable word in there. We just thought about that a little further. Sorry, had more confusion. I think it's okay, but...
Could it just be 10% or 500 square feet of the ground floor?
Of the ground floor or in conjunction with the ground floor commercial space like I originally had it. Maybe that's rather than required.
How about we do this? How about we take a break and let's just make sure
Sorry
you guys
about
are
the
good.
Last
no,
minute,
no, no apologies.
Anyway.
You've done,
write, I'm
you've
write
done
this
a
out.
Really tremendous job on all of this. So we are at...
Okay.
Let's see, 8:11, why don't we go till about 8:20, and then we'll be ready, and then Council Member Darris can get ready to race up here. Wording for us on mixed use.
Yes, we'll put it up on the screen. Charles, I did just want to confirm we did a little bit of mapping, and there are no parcels on sewer less than an acre outside the urbanized area, so all of those properties would now be eligible for SB 9.
Thank you.
There we are. There's our language. And essentially he says residential uses allowed only on second and third floors if a project is required to comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act and doesn't have an elevator. One accessible unit may be located on a ground floor in conjunction with ground floor commercial space, not to exceed the greater of 500 square feet or 10% of the size of the commercial space, or not to exceed 1,000 square feet.
Well done. And I like that you have may, because then they can, if somebody doesn't want to do the unit, they can simply comply with the ADA building requirements and we're good. All right. We have consensus? Yes. We're good.
Gold star is all
right. All right. So I am ready for someone to make a motion. And if you want to put that motion up there. All right. There's only three of us.
Okay. I will move the recommendations as listed before us with the inclusion of the typo fixes that staff identified previously and as amended by removing item B on the mixed use language. That would be
I think we can say adding the mixed use language read by the city clerk.
Right. Okay. But then I think she's also mentioning B from the 1,200 square foot, the provided language.
Removing the three bedroom requirement.
The three bedroom
right,
requirement.
Right. That's what I'm.
Oh, is that where you're
right? That's
oh,
okay, that was what
it.
I was trying to do. I see. B in the mixed.
Got it.
Eliminating the three bedroom requirement, and on the. Square. Okay, which page? And where's our 1,200 square foot?
That's the one you just.
That's
okay. 9-5-0508-2
together. Okay.
So.
Okay.
I think. And then I think you could just say, and then changing the language for the footnote in ordinance B is enough too.
Okay, and changing the. Language of the footnote and ordinance be as displayed by staff during the meeting.
And I do see our city attorney. Did you have something to say before we finish out our motion?
No, I'm sure Laura's going to tell you this, but she needs to read the ordinance by title.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, I will second the motion.
All right, we've got a motion by Councilmember Funk and a second by Councilmember Bourbeau. And I will now ask the city clerk to read the title of the ordinance.
Thank you. Draft Ordinance A, an ordinance of the City Council of the City of Atascadero, California, amending Title IX, Planning and Zoning, to repeal and replace Chapter 5, Accessory Dwelling Units of the Atascadero Municipal Code, and Draft Ordinance B, an ordinance of the City Council of the City of Atascadero, California, amending Sections 9-3.330, 9-3.490, 9-3.500, 9-3.651, 9-3.662, 9-3.679, 9-3.677, 9-4.106, 9-4.107, 9-4.1089, 9-4.116, 9-4.128, 9-6.103, 9-6.106, 9-9.102 of Title IX, Planning and Zoning of the Atascadero Municipal Code for consistency with state regulations regarding accessory dwelling units and urban dwelling units.
I think you need a drink of water after that.
Councilmember Bourbeau?
Yes.
Councilmember Funk?
Yes.
Mayor Moreno?
Yes, ma'am.
Motion passes.
Thank you. And thank you, staff. Well done. I know it was a lot of work on that over many, many months, and appreciate it. Pulled together something really good. And thank you to my colleagues. Well done. And we will now welcome back Councilmember Darris. Happy. And now we are moving on to our one management report, which is the on the Wrestling Bacant statue enhancements. And this will be our Public Works Director, Mr. Nick DeBar.
you, Mayor Moreno. Let me get my screen pulled up here.
Brief.
All right. So this item should be maybe about half the time of the previous item. I'm just kidding. It should be a pretty quick item here.
We know you, Nick, so you scare us when you say that.
I'll try to do this in a
The chief is right next to you, and he can use an elbow if
maybe
need be.
Maybe the clerk could put the three-minute timer up.
Let me see. Okay, here we go. All right, so a little history on the maiden statue. In 2005, there's not a master park plan for Sunken Gardens, which is kind of interesting, but it is a passive park, so there's not a lot of athletic fields that need to be planned and everything else like we did with the pickleball courts. But there was a concept plan that was adopted by council, and that was during the downtown enhancement projects. And part of the project included removal, restoration, and replacement of the wrestling Bacchantes statue. By the way, this statue has probably, Rochelle, maybe three different names that we've seen, three or four. But I think the official name is wrestling Bacchantes. This actually statue is a solid piece of Carrara marble. It was commissioned by the Italian government and then donated to the 1904 World's Fair. And then our city's founding father, E.G. Lewis, purchased it and donated to the colony. So currently there's one of the things that didn't get done when this was replaced was some enhancements for the statue. If you recall or seen that before, there was like unfinished concrete base that was placed on. And recently we had in the budget, in the CIP, we had $15,000 to do some enhancements to that. We actually found a lot of the old bricks from the old City Hall building that fell off this building out at the courtyard. We repurposed those with some white marble that was given to the city as well, and incorporated that design in the base of that statue, incorporating details from the City Hall. So if you ever go out there and look up at the rotunda areas that surround this room, it actually has these diamond-shaped patterns on it. So we also are in process of doing some irrigation, extending irrigation, irrigating that area. We need to do a little regrading just to get positive drainage away from the statue base. And then we're also working on a monument with a plaque. So there's not a monument currently there or a plaque. Through this process, we actually, the statue kind of faces towards a fountain, and it's, I'll go back to this slide here, but it's located right in this area here, but it's only, has one side of it, has a sidewalk to it, and it's not the front side of the statue, it's actually the back side of the statue, and so we got thinking about for maintenance and landscaping and everything else, and just being able to let people walk around the statue and provide an accessible pathway. We thought it might be nice to put a little very narrow sidewalk around it just to provide some access. So here's a little schematic of what we're proposing to do. It's a 4-foot wide sidewalk. It actually has on the two corners, the reverse curve bulb out kind of matches some of the design in the sidewalk in Sunken Gardens and around the corners of sidewalk corners around the block. But what it would do, it would really help us out a little bit more with some maintenance activities. So when we're mowing when our guys are mowing the park, a lot of times it's easier to mow around if you have a sidewalk to mow up against. It also doesn't blow a lot of that cut grass into the planting areas and maybe reseed. If you see some of the new trees we planted out there, the coast redwoods, they've got grass growing up in the mulch area just because they're right next to the turf. It would also help with some of the irrigation overspray. So currently, you know, it's hard to maintain and contain that irrigation into the turf areas, but having a little four-foot buffer from that planting area in the statue would assist us in making sure we water the grass and keeping it off the statue. The hard water that we have in town, too, also could stain some of that brick. So, I think most importantly, we want to encourage visitors to our town that, you know, allow them to have a pathway to walk around the statue and, you know, see all four sides of it. So, learn about the history of it as well. So that plaque will give some more detail. Here's a couple photos we have currently as it exists today. So it would be basically three sides, putting the concrete sidewalk around that. So really, tonight, recommendations are pretty simple. Just staff's looking to have council approve the addition of a viewing sidewalk around the wrestling Bacchante statue and add that to the Sunken Gardens concept plan. Then also authorize the Director of Administrative Services to reallocate $7,000 in 2010 bond proceeds, master agreement funds to the Wrestling Bacchantes project from Centennial Bridge and Plaza project. So we did have some remaining funds from that project that we're looking just to reallocate. And the cost of the sidewalk, actually, the brickwork was very reasonable. Our mason that we hired, was like $3,500. Some plantings. We just want to make sure we have enough to do that sidewalk. So we are looking for $7,000, and I'm quite confident that we'll complete this project. So with that, I can take any questions you have.
Thank you, Director. And these are funds, as you said, part of the 2010 bond proceeds that have to be used for certain projects, and this is one of those projects, so we can't just take it and, you know, give it to Echo or, you know, something like that. This isn't money that is fungibly be used in any way we want.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you. Any council questions? Nope, seeing none. I will go ahead and open up to public comment, and if there's anyone wishing to speak, you can go ahead and raise your hand. I am not seeing anyone. We will bring it back to council, and I will look for discussion or a motion.
I will move that we approve staff's recommendation to add the sidewalk and authorize the Director of Administrative Services to reallocate the necessary funds.
I'll second.
We have a motion by Councilmember Barbeau, a second by Councilmember Darris. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Barbeau?
Yes.
Councilmember Darris?
Yes.
Councilmember Funk?
Yes.
Mayor Moreno?
Yes, ma'am. Motion passes. Thank you. We're on to individual council announcements and committee reports. I will start with Councilmember Darris.
I don't really have anything to report other than I was privileged to go to a luncheon this afternoon for CAPSLO's employees recognition for years served. They shortened it. They did 20 and under, I guess, a couple weeks ago via Zoom. But there were four or five employees that were getting their 25 years and one for 45 years, which was pretty remarkable. So they have obviously have some longevity. CAPSLO does a lot of great things throughout our counties, and they're very much appreciated, and the employees, of course. Thank you.
Councilmember Borba?
The only thing I'd comment on is the Integrated Waste Management Authority established a program to help to subsidize purchases of compost so that can then be credited to all the jurisdictions, including ours, as meeting their compost procurement requirement or their organic procurement requirement. And that program is up and running and has already participants. So they are already generating credits in that regard for jurisdictions, including ours. Although the governor just recently signed legislation that delayed the penalty phase for not doing that. So there's a little more time, but it's good that the IWMA is getting a program up and running to help the cities comply with that.
And you did attend a countywide mayor's meeting in my state.
I did attend the countywide mayor's meeting last Friday on behalf of Mayor Moreno, and nothing great consequence to report, but I will discuss a little more with you directly.
Yes, thank you very much. Councilmember Funk.
Yes, I had a meeting of the HSOC Executive Committee last week, and we continue to move forward in implementing the strategic plan on homelessness. And pursuant to that, I was also involved in a meeting this afternoon on as part of the oversight of the data work to be done. The county information systems is working very thoroughly to make sure that the data solutions meet the needs of a whole variety of constituents. And you know what? It's a really complicated process to get people out of homelessness. There are a whole lot of pieces of it involved. And so they're getting an education in that complexity. And the Atascadero Basin Groundwater Sustainability Agency met this afternoon, and it was on routine business, just checking in. It was such a fast meeting that I was trying to sign in from Zoom from the other meeting, and it was all right, missed it. It was all done by the time I could get the Zoom connection. So, you know, that was, I think we had a great controversy on approving the minutes.
That was as quick as Director DeBar's report tonight. Very well done. And I actually have nothing of note to report. I'll have RTA next week. And thank you to Councilmember Borbeau for attending the Countywide Mayor's Roundtable meeting on my behalf. And with that, I will see if there are any individual determinations.
I would just make a note that ballots are out and encourage people to participate in the civic process and get them in by November 8th.
November 8th, yes, please do vote. And with that, meeting adjourned.